imagery, as we've just heard. So if you're in high school using the handouts, make sure you give it a good crack using drawing something from our passage. And like Josh said, if you've got one of the weekly snacks and my explanations start to lose you, feel free to try and draw something that you think is happening in the passage. And if you want, pop it into the offertory box at the end of the service, and I'll give the best drawing something next week. I'll also be changing my words between the Lord, Lord in capitals, and Yahweh. Yahweh is God's personal name to his people, and Lord in capitals is showing that personal name. But first, let's start by watching a video on the screen. You've got to press play.
Are you remorseful for the pain and the heartache?
God is blowing his own trumpet to the world, announcing his coming.
I'm so confused. Yeah.
He says in 2025, in September of the 23rd and the 24th, I will come to take my church.
Did he come?
Did he come?
For a fact that it's God. So the question is that, did you test the spirit?
Where's your part? I did my part. I delivered the message. Why you didn't rapture the people?
Hearing about rapture, the next thing you are hearing about dates, can't we just preach rapture, teach about rapture without dates?
It's midnight on the 24th. There is no rapture. What am I?
Okay. That was Pastor Joshua Mlakela. He said Jesus appeared to him in a vision and gave him the exact date the rapture would happen. September 23rd, 2025. And 3 days after that date passed, nothing happened. He went back on the same podcast as we saw there, and he doubled down, fully convinced, insisting his job was only to speak the message that he'd been given. Now, if you really want to watch those 2 long-hour episodes, I'm reluctant to send it to you, because I think your time is better spent elsewhere, like Zechariah 14. But somehow, the rapture always makes it onto the news, or it makes it viral on social media. I call it the rapture, call it the day of the Lord, call it judgment day, different names for mostly the same event. And it's usually described in graphic, unfamiliar imagery, in this style of writing called apocalyptic. Things aren't meant to be taken literal, but it's still pointing to a truth that's going to unfold. We kind of scratch our heads at the imagery, but more than just confusion, I think there's something that stirs within us when we hear about the rapture or the day of the Lord. And I think maybe there's a bit of FOMO, maybe there's a bit of fear of missing out. Like, did I make the right calls in life? Or maybe there's a bit of dread. If Jesus is coming back and my life isn't in order, is he going to accept me? Zechariah 14 doesn't neatly fit into that apocalyptic category, but it shares a lot of the same language and imagery. So today we'll look back with Zechariah, and we'll also look forward with the New Testament, because this chapter has a now and not yet concept. It's partially fulfilled at the resurrection, but it will be completed at Jesus' second return. And what I want everyone to get out of this passage is to reconsider what it is you're actually looking forward to. Okay. In the time of Zechariah, they were in despair and without hope. And so this was a message of hope, something to look forward to. And in our day, I think our issue is that we have too many things we look forward to, that we forget the day of the Lord and forget to look forward to that. But something we're all looking forward to, I'm sure, is next Wednesday, the Origin Decider. And I reckon a few of us have already got a sickie planned. Maybe not. But we know the team. We've got the snacks sorted. We're locked in. But do we know the day of the Lord like we know the Origin team? Are we as excited for it as we are for Wednesday night? And for you, it might not be the footy. It might be this once-in-a-lifetime experience. But in my view, I don't think we as Christians look forward to the day when God's kingdom is fully established. And I think part of our non-excitement is that we're just busy. We're busy building our own kingdoms here. And so whatever your version of Wednesday night is, I want us to be more excited about the day of the Lord than anything here on earth. And so as the final chapter of the book, chapter 14 in Zechariah, kind of brings the themes to a climax. The great battle on that day in which Yahweh's enemies are subdued and his people are saved and blessed. It kind of ends with his people worshiping him as king of a new creation. So let's look at our passage. I'm going to be preaching from the whole of chapter 14. And so we see at the beginning of our passage that it is the Lord who gathers the nations against Jerusalem. Look with me, verse 2. Verse 2 says, "I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem for battle." And this battle seems like it's like a siege against Jerusalem. And it's the Lord who puts this into motion. But why? Why does he gather all the nations for battle? We've seen throughout Zechariah that Israel is not innocent. They're still his precious people, but they've sinned against the Lord. A couple of weeks ago, we saw how Israel's leaders were meant to be shepherds, but were in fact corrupt. Time and time again, the Lord has been asking for Israel's loyalty to him. But Israel is quick to take advantage of the Lord's patience. And so the Lord judges Israel for their sins, and in his judgment, half go into exile and half remain in the city. And this isn't a contradiction to chapter 13, which speaks about one-third being saved and two-thirds going away. Again, the writing style is apocalyptic. And so what are we thinking? What's the point it's trying to get across? And the point is, some who are Israel will not be saved, and some who are Israel will be saved. What happens next? Verse 3. "Then the Lord will go out to fight against those nations as he fights on a day of battle." In what seems to be like a turn of events, the Lord goes out to fight against the nations that he's gathered in. And the Lord has fought numerous battles for Israel in the past. He remembers his promise all the way back to Genesis 15 in being their God. Even with Israel's unfaithfulness, the Lord remains faithful and fights as Israel's champion. There's this really cool image in the next verse. Let's read it together. Verse 4. "On that day, his feet, the Lord's feet, will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east." You can imagine this verse in a movie screen. All the enemies are about to overpower the good guys. And then in the bottom left-hand corner of the screen comes the feet of the hero. There's a bit of dust that flies up in the air. The camera kind of pans around. We see this hero's silhouette in the foreground. Enemies are in the background. It's kind of the picture that's happening here. As the Lord stands on the Mount of Olives, and it will be split from half from east to west, forming a huge valley in between. So that half the mountain will move to the north and half to the south. And verse 5, "You, remnant of Israel, you will flee by my mountain valley, for the valley of the mountains will extend to Azal." The word "split" in verse 4 also describes the parting of the Red Sea in Exodus, when God's people also fled. Zechariah has in mind God's provision to escape to safety in the future, just as God provided escape to safety in the Exodus. And as we look forward to Zechariah from Zechariah's time, we know that God will one day come down as the eternal Word become flesh. The God-man, Jesus, will one day stand on the Mount of Olives and he ascends into heaven to reign as king after providing an escape to safety from sin through his death and resurrection. And Scripture promises that he'll stand there again. The angels told the disciples in Acts 1 that the same Jesus who left the Mount of Olives will return the same way to finish the rescue he started. That's worth being excited about, isn't it? A king who fights for you, a king who lays down his life for you. Let's see what else happens on the day of the Lord, verses 6 and 7. On that day, there will be no light. The sunlight and moonlight will diminish. It will be a unique day known only to the Lord, without day or night, but there will be light at evening. When the Lord comes, the current created order will be reordered. Verses 6 and 7 really boggled me when I was trying to understand the passage, because it says it's not going to be light, and in the next verse it says there's going to be light. And so I was like, what's happening here? Where I ended up is that it's giving Genesis 1 vibes. It's getting us to remember God as the loving creator in Genesis. He created the sun and the moon to give light to the world. And so we see that this day is not a day of darkness, but rather it is a reordered day of continual light. It continues to shine into the evening. And again, Zechariah he's echoing Isaiah's picture of the Lord himself as everlasting light, when the sun and moon are no longer needed because the Lord's own glory lights everything. As we read in our second reading, Revelation 21 picks up the same picture. Susie, if you can press next on the slide. He says up here, the city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it because the glory of the Lord illuminates it. And its lamp is the Lamb. Can you see how Zechariah is thinking back to Isaiah as he looks forward to the day of the Lord? Back to Zechariah, verse 8. On that day, living water will flow out from Jerusalem, half of it toward the eastern sea and half toward the western sea, in summer and winter alike. The phrase living waters has two meanings. One of them is that the waters are fresh. It's not old or contaminated. And it's waters that give life. Looking back, it recalls Genesis 2, where the life-giving water flows out of Eden to water the garden and then to the earth. In Australia, it can be hard to appreciate the value of water. We're surrounded by it, and our water is clean to safe and drink. Truman and I recently went to Vietnam, and one of the things we had to look out for was the quality of water. People in Vietnam don't drink tap water like we do here. They drink bottled water. They use bottled water even for something like brushing your teeth. That's the type of water that they need to avoid. So having clean water is really underappreciated. Jerusalem had different water issues. They often experienced water supply difficulties. And so this picture of living waters flowing out everywhere is a picture of hope. It's a picture of abundance of life and quality of life. The new world will be reordered, recreated, where the glory of God illuminates it, and its lamp is the Lamb. Living water will flow to the whole earth in all season. It's a picture of unending, unfiltered access and intimacy with the triune God. That's worth getting excited about, isn't it? Look with me, verse 9. On that day, the Lord will become king over the whole earth, the Lord alone, and his name alone. This verse here is the high point of the whole vision. Zechariah has spoken of a coming Davidic king, a true shepherd, a mediating priest. And we know these promises are fulfilled in one person, Jesus. I want us to skip to the end of verse 11. It says, Jerusalem will dwell in security. The remnant that escaped through God's provision comes home to safety. No more war. No more famine, only protection and abundance. Again, it's the same picture of Zechariah 2. God himself as a wall of fire around the city and his glory within it. And then abruptly, the scene cuts to a plague on the nations who came against Jerusalem. Flesh rotting, eyes rotting, limbs rotting. An image of decay and death. It recalls the plagues of the Exodus, where judgment from God means death, but salvation from God means life. And then something surprising happens in our passage. Look at verse 16. Then all the survivors from the nations that came against Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the king, the Lord of armies, and to celebrate the festival of shelters. The nations turn from warriors to worshippers. Even Egypt, like the archetypal enemy of the Exodus, comes to worship Yahweh. And all the nations are gathered in judgment, but they're also invited to worship. The Lord is the one who saves. Even the Egyptians, who are the big baddies, they will be saved too, if they worship the one true king. Where else do we see perfect justice and abounding grace? That's worth getting excited about, isn't it? Worshipping the one true king of justice and grace. Finishing off with verse 20 and 21. On that day, the words "holy to the Lord" will be on the bells of the horses. The pots in the house of the Lord will be like the sprinkling basins before the altar. Every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah will be holy to the Lord of armies. All who sacrifice will come and use the pots to cook in. And on that day, there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of armies. Holy to the Lord was an inscription worn on the gold plate by the high priest. It was the single holiest object in the whole priestly garment. And on the day of the Lord, the most holiest object that once belonged to the priest will be on a horse, will be on a harness, it'll be on the bell. It's about as unholy an object as you could get. The most ordinary thing becomes holy. And that last line, "no Canaanite in the house of the Lord," it carries a double meaning. A Canaanite can mean traitor, and in Zechariah, that's not a job you want. So removing the traitor means removing wickedness. We saw that in chapter 5. Traitor, not to be confused with tradee, the traitor. Okay. Canaanite also means the people group, the idolaters from the land of Canaan. Either way, the holiness of Yahweh will flood the whole land, impacting everything and everyone. That's worth being excited about, isn't it? No more wickedness and sin, everything holy and pure. So, Wednesday night. The night is all planned. We know the team. You may or may not have a sticky planned. For 80 minutes, everything will hang on a coin's width of form and a referee's whistle. The day of the Lord is not like that. It was never a contest. The Lord gathers the nations for battle in verse 2, and it's the same Lord who wins it in verse 3. The result was never in doubt. The battle was won at the cross when Jesus suffered, died, and rose. Sin and death were defeated. Both the nations and Israel are judged and saved, whether they worship the one true king. It's a picture of what has already come in Jesus and what will eventuate when Jesus comes back. This picture of judgment and invitation is exactly what Jesus started doing at the very festival Zechariah pictures. At the Feast of Shelters, John tells us, Jesus stood up and called out to anyone thirsty could come to him and drink. He said that he himself is the light of the world. It's that same living water picture, that same unfading light. As Zechariah promised, it would flow from Jerusalem on the day of the Lord. And Jesus says, life and light flows from me. Will you come and have life to the full? Will you come out of darkness and into the light? And so here's my challenge for the week. Check your calendar of anticipation. What are you clearing space for? What are you counting down to? A footy match? A milestone? A holiday? None of it compares to the day of the Lord when Yahweh will become king over the whole earth, the Lord alone and his name alone. That's worth getting excited about. Let's look forward to that.